Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Max Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. The 5th of October 2022 marks 60 years since Dr. No first premiered. So to celebrate 60 years of Bond, we'll be talking about the greatest Bond movie moments over three very special episodes, featuring more cameos than Casino Royale 1967. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me for the second part of our Bond movie moment series, he's the Jaws to my dolly, it's Mr. Brendan Duffy.
am I wearing braces? No, are you wearing braces?
I am. And if Brendan is my Jaws, then he's our Baron Samedi, it's Mr. Tom Wheatley returning to the podcast.
Oh, I'll take that, I like that one. Yeah. Cheers.
So across these three episodes, you'll hear from our lovely listeners, other podcasts, friends of the show and guests old and new who've all chosen their own favourite moments from the Bond films of Roger Moore and Timothy Dalton. So before we get on to our guests, what are the moments that you two would like to highlight from the Moore and Dalton eras that haven't been referenced by our guests? Brendan, you go first.
I'm surprised Noah's mentioned the Live and Let Die boat chase. Mm-hmm. Because it spans a vast amount of river. I mean, it goes on for a while, as we touched on in the episode. But again, I'm picking one that it's like a mini Bond movie on its own. But the chase, it's just relentless. And Bond has to defeat so many people in that chase and also ruin a wedding.
Yeah.
He outwits the police as well. And annoys the police, which is good to see.
But which police in particular, Brendan? Come on, say his name.
Sheriff. Sheriff J.W. Pepper.
That's who you... That's the subtext of your moment, isn't it?
Yes.
That it's J.W. Yeah. Pepper.
Basically. Yeah. And I'm surprised no one's mentioned him.
Yeah, I mean, it's an action centrepiece for the movie, isn't it? And brilliantly staged on location. Roger Moore, let's not forget, got injured on this one as well, putting himself on the line. Probably why he spent a lot of later movies relying on stuntmen. But that boat chase in Live and Let Die is superb. What about you, Wheatley?
So I'll briefly touch on the one that I do think is the top one, but I know somebody else is going to talk about this. But the opening sequence to The Spy Who Loved Me, I just think is... it's like the most perfect little opening sequence that probably exists in any Bond film. Some of the Bond films that you get have really long sequences. There's like three locations. I don't think that's how a Bond opening sequence should be. I think this is the perfect one. It's just one scene, some great skiing, some slightly stupider skiing, and then you've got the parachute opening with the Unijack. And I think you look at, if you ask anyone of a certain age, you say, give me a Bond moment, they'll probably go, oh, the Union Jack opening with the parachute. I think Alan Partridge talks about that quite a bit as well, doesn't it? Sort of stamped its place on the zeitgeist. But I won't go into too much depth there. The actual one, because somebody else is going to mention that, I'll talk about the one that I picked. Now, this isn't my favourite scene of Roger Moore's, but I think it is very iconic in the same way that Union Jack parachute is. And that's the Live and Let Die crocodile scene where he runs across the crocodiles. It just sort of sums up Roger Moore so easily, so simply, because if Daniel Craig was doing that, it would be a perilous situation where it'd be quite scary. It's just not with Roger. It's just ridiculous. But the fact that it was real, that they really did that scene, just makes it go show that Roger had this amazing ability to make something that was actually quite dangerous and scary just seem nonsense. But I love it. I mean, I imagine at the time when people were watching it, that was mind-blowing effect and a mind-blowing thing to do. Now it just seems like a silly carry-on sketch, but it's a fantastic sequence, and I think, yeah, it just sums up Roger Moore perfectly.
But the fact that they did it for real elevates it, doesn't it? Because if you could see that they were just like foam crocodiles or whatever, you'd just go, well.
But nobody would believe it now. If you showed that to somebody and said, watch this, they'd go, that's good, it's funny. That's real. That's a real action sequence that they spent ages filming with real crocodiles. I think that's part of the beauty of it.
Absolutely. For Roger, for me, I mean, I totally agree. Spy Who Loved Me, I think, is one of the pinnacle. In fact, if not the pinnacle of the Bond series in terms of moments that sort of come to define the character. It's action spectacle. It's humour. And it ends with an absolutely killer stunt that
and fantastic role by Billington.
Don't leave
Billington out.
That's a good callback. It's just absolutely superb. And also has ramifications later in the film, right? It's not just one of those standalone pre-title sequences that doesn't have an impact later on. It's all tied in with the plot with Agent XXX. And so for that reason, I think it's one of the best. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about another iconic Spy Who Loved Me moment, which is the Lotus Esprit, Roger never got to drive the Aston Martin, but he did get the second most iconic Bond car, which for me is the White Lotus Esprit, which turns into a submarine. That action sequence for me, it tops, it exceeds what they managed with Goldfinger. It's came to define the 70s Bond. It's a cool looking car. It does absolutely ridiculous things. It's completely implausible, but the way that they achieve it with all the special effects, the model cars, the actual submarines that they used, all that sort of stuff is brilliant. And then there's the final moment when the boat comes to shore, the guy double takes and Roger then drops a fish out the window. It's so silly, but it works.
Yeah, you've pretty much summed up Roger there, haven't you? Cool and implausible. Fantastic.
From cool and implausible to very cool and plausible, let's talk about Dalton. Brendan?
Well, I think the scene in License to Kill where he confronts M and he's got that simmering rage and he basically leaves, you know, goes rogue. I think that scene is fantastic, and it's not something again, more recently, we've seen it. We've seen him confront M all the time, but, you know, up to before this point, we'd seen him pretty much toe the line. So to see this and see him then run off and then they don't know where he is for the rest of the film is fantastic.
But I love that as well, though, that he has this confrontation with M, but M sort of lets him go as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's M's basically got to do his job, but also understands why Bond's doing what he's doing. It's a difficult decision from M, isn't it?
Yeah. and the Farewell to Arms line, because it's at Hemingway's house, is a lovely sort of chef's kiss moment. Wheatley?
So I'm going for, and for some reason I've just realised that I'm only picking scenes that have got snow in them. That's not intentional. I only like Bond when he's in the snow. I'll go for Living Daylights, when he's the sort of snow chase scene that starts with the Vantage V8 and then ends up on the cello. I think the reason I like, well, I don't think this is an amazing scene, but I think it is iconic for Dalton, because Dalton gets quite a few action scenes, but they tend to be quite gritty action sequences. There's not a lot of fun in them. I think there's this fun in it, in this one. I think you could see any of the Bonds doing this, and even Roger. Starts off pretty hard, pretty gritty. The Vantage is it the Vantage? Vantage yeah. 8, isn't it? Yeah. It's pretty cool sequence. Cello just gets ridiculous, and to the point where I think he shows his passport, doesn't he, when he goes across the border on the cello.
Nothing to declare.
Which is a Roger moment. It's definitely not for Dalton. I just think it's a very nice, interesting sequence. You look at some of the other Dalton sequences, like the one at the end of Living Daylights in the plane. It goes on for ages. There's not a lot of humour in it. It sort of drags a bit. Whereas this one is a lot happening. It's a very fun sequence to watch, and it almost elevates Dalton for me into something that he didn't get the opportunity to do in a lot of the other, well, all the other sequences in the films.
Yeah, one action sequence that one of our guests does mention is the one, the water skiing moment in License to Kill, which I think does sort of almost reach the heights of the cello scene. But it's a great moment, isn't it? And that whole idea of the cello is a theme that runs throughout the movie. So it sort of typifies Living Daylights, doesn't it?
Yeah.
For me, I've chosen the finale of License to Kill with the lorry chase, because it's just one of the greatest action sequences for me committed to film for the Bond series. It feels visceral. If they were to do it now, there'd be a lot of CGI and digital replacement, but it was all done in camera for real. They really tipped up a lorry to go on its side. I mean, it doesn't make sense at all, but it works in the scheme of it. You can almost feel the heat of the explosions. You can smell the gasoline. And Dalton is just completely unflappable in his sort of pursuit of revenge in this moment. And I think that just really typifies his era of Bond. It's gritty, it's real. Dalton is a true thespian, but he gives it his all. He really doesn't look down on the material. He really embraces the material, and that's why I love that moment. So, on this episode, you will hear from Val Pacheco, Mark Harrison, Neil Alcock, Mark Edlitz, Steve O'Brien, John Ortiz, Mark Miller, the guys from Clash of the Title, and first of all, let's hear from our listener, Lane Bruce.
Hi, fellas. My name is Lane, and I'm an avid listener from the U.S. I haven't missed an episode of the show since I started binge listening about a year ago. I pride myself on being an expert about the Bond film series, having been a fan for over 40 years, but I always learn new things each episode, so thank you for the effort that you put into this. I really love the podcast. My choice for one of the most underrated moments in the series comes from The Man with the Golden Gun, which is a movie I generally feel is underrated overall, and I truly feel as though it has one of the series' best villains. And the precise moment I chose is Lunch with Bond, Scaramanga, and Goodnight at the Funhouse Island Mansion. Scaramanga's monologue about growing up in the circus is a sad and chilling moment that offers a depth of character and motivation rarely seen among the other flashier and more maniacal villains in the series. And Christopher Lee's performance is just terrific here and through the entire movie, truly. And the danger implied in the scene is underscored by how serious that Roger Moore actually plays it. So these are two colorful but ultimately cold assassins at their best.
When I kill, it's on the specific orders of my government. And those I kill are themselves killers.
Oh, come, Mr. Bond. You disappoint me. You get as much fulfillment out of killing as I do, so why don't you admit it?
I admit killing you would be a pleasure.
You should have done that when you first saw me. But then, of course, the English don't consider it sporting to kill in cold blood, do they?
Don't count on that.
Hey, Tom and Brendan, thank you for inviting Alex and myself from Clash of the Titles to talk about our favourite Bond movie moment, although we've just got in the studio and realised...
This is your fault. You didn't explain it clearly enough. I thought it was Bond movie.
Alex has done his best movie and he's written notes, so if it's okay, he's going to do that.
Yeah, but I'll pick a moment from the movie, so it'll still work within the confines of the question, but apologies. I'm sorry.
Okay. Alex, what's your favourite Bond movie moment?
Well, my favourite Bond movie moment is The Spy Who Loved Me. I think it is truly the greatest Bond movie ever. I absolutely adore that film. It's such a fun movie. I mean, sure, Stromberg isn't the greatest villain in the world, but because they couldn't get the Spectre rights, I believe, and it was meant to be Blofeld, he's a good surrogate Blofeld. It's the only Bond movie that has actually made me scared in real life. The idea of a lift floor disappearing and you sliding down into a water tank with a shark in it meant that for a good portion of my childhood, I wedged myself in the corners of lifts so that I had no weight on the floor in case the floor gave way and put me in a shark tank.
So that's your favourite moment?
No, my favourite moment's the opening, obviously. I think it's genius. I think the bit where the parachute opens, first of all, that free fall jump is epic. And then the minute that parachute, I mean, Bond made a parachute iconic. When it opens into the Union Jack, dun, dun, and the score kicks in, bosh. There you go. That is actually my favourite moment. Chris?
So I think, and forgive me if I'm wrong here, Tom, I think when we worked together, we might have done a list of the best Bond movie moments. A huge thing that we did, and we put all the clips online, and then we were told, copyright, you can't do that. Had to pull them all down. But I'm pretty sure we worked on this together. If we didn't, apologies. But in my memory, the number one moment that we picked is the number one moment I'm picking now. And that is...
Go on.
The beginning of The Spy Who Loved Me.
No!
Yeah! What are the chances?
Wow!
So, it kicks off with Bond getting it on in a cabin with a woman. He receives a fax to his digital watch. He dons an inconspicuous yellow ski suit with red backpack. He gets chased down the mountain. He fires bullets from the ski poles while flipping over the baddies. We've got close-ups of Roger Moore, very clearly not on the mountains. And as you say, he skis towards the edge of that cliff. He skis off the edge of the cliff. He falls for what seems like forever in silence. Then the parachute opens. It's a Union frigging Jack. And as you said, the music kicks in. It's less 007 and more 00 Heaven.
Lovely.
So actually, you ended up with the same pick for both of us. We didn't even plan that.
Wow. Incredible.
Awesome.
Thanks anyway, for having us on, guys.
Yeah, good luck with the rest of the show. Cheers. Bye.
That's not the end of the beginning. The end of the beginning goes like this. Clang. Glang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang. Glang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang-a-lang. Nobody does it better. And I'm a naked woman in silhouette with a gun, spinning round.
Welcome back to the podcast, the creator of Kick-Ass, Kingsman, Wanted, Jupiter's Legacy, Super Crooks, head of Miller World, and also the creator of the recent comic King of Spies, is Mr. Mark Miller.
Hi there, how's it going?
Very well, Mark. Thank you so much for coming back to talk about 60 years of James Bond. I feel like we're putting you on the spot a little bit on asking you to name a moment, your favourite movie moment. But are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm good to go.
What have you gone for?
Well, it's funny. My mind is flooded with so many cool moments because the thing about Bond, probably more than any sort of pre-Marvel franchise, is so much of it is based around cool moments, isn't it? Like every film's got 10 cool moments and then you multiply that by over 20 films and it's actually almost impossible. But I narrow it down from even great ones like Goldfinger, Moonraker, all this kind of thing. I narrow it down to The Spy Who Loved Me, and I narrow it down, Spy Who Loved Me, to the train fight. And the thing is, the train fight between Roger Moore and Richard Kiel, James Bond and Jaws, I'd never seen anything like it. I was seven, and I think I saw it before I saw Star Wars. So I hadn't really seen a blockbuster before. This was my first time seeing a big blockbuster in the cinema. So this was a battle royale, you know, this fight. I'd never seen the From Russia with Love train fight. And I know it was a bit of a nod to that. But for me, this is the original Bond train fight, you know. And I was so obsessed with it that I acted it out for weeks after I'd seen the movie. And I would get friends and family and everything to be Jaws. And I obviously was James Bond, dressed up in a sort of school uniform come, you know, Bond style outfit and everything. And I'd just act it out every day. And the big thing I did, we had a low window at our dining room that I was able to kick someone out of, and they landed on what was usually grass. I'd elaborately set the whole thing up and everything, and I'd boot whoever it was, one of my friends, in the face, and they would go back out the window at the end of our big simulation, you know? So I think for me, that's the moment. That's the one.
That's great. I mean, when you said train fight, yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to distinguish which one you were going to go for, really, because it is a cornerstone of the franchise, isn't it? Going back to, like, say, From Russia with Love. But also, let's not forget, Roger had his other train fight as well. He'd already done one in Live and Let Die.
That's true. That's true. Which I just watched recently on the big screen again. You know, the Bond retrospective that's been going on for the 60th anniversary. And you know what? My friend Nick Sedgefield, who I go with every week, the two of us go and see Bond every single Tuesday night. And the thing we realised is even the ones that aren't as beloved as others are still 10 out of 10 on the big screen. Whenever you watch Bond on the big screen, like Live and Let Die and Man with a Golden Gun aren't as beloved as Moonraker and Spy You Love Me. But my God, they're great when you see them on the big screen. And that fight is also awesome.
I mean, they are big screen animals, aren't they? And I do think that sometimes is forgotten, especially when you watch some of the more muted ones at home. Brendan and I have had very similar experiences recently. Mm. Which was the one that really struck out to you, Brendan, on the big screen?
You Only Live Twice is the one that, for me, it's just that final third act, the volcano.
Yeah.
It just offers something that you don't get if you're watching it on like 40-inch TV.
And your senses tell you this exists. You know, they did make that big interior, that big Ken Adams set. Mm. You know it's not CGI, it's not green screen for two-thirds of that or anything. This is a real thing you're looking at. And there's just some... When you see the curtains going back at the beginning of a Bond film and then you see the screen going back and back and back and you think, oh, we're in for something expensive here. You know, this looked really cool.
Interesting that you chose this moment, Mark, from The Spy Who Loved Me, because that is a film... for me, that is packed with iconic moments.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there some? Was it the fact that it was something that you could relate to, not relate to necessarily, but something that you could act out, something you could recreate at home that perhaps really struck a chord?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, I was seven when I saw it, you know, so the sort of getting off with somebody scenes, no chance, right? That was never going to happen, right, when I'm playing it at home, you know? But also going off the cliff with a parachute, that's never happening either, you know. So I had to be realistic in my ambitions. So, and even the car chases, blowing up the helicopter, all that kind of thing, you know. The other thing I did like, though, is when Stromberg is at the end of that preposterously long dinner table and, you know, you've got the gunshot all the way along that steel tube. And I never really quite got the logic of that steel tube. Even as a kid, I remember sort of thinking, that doesn't really physically make much sense. You know, like it'd be easier just to shoot him. And under the table, like that tube isn't carrying the bullet along specifically. You know? It's so ridiculous. But it's so brilliant, you know. So as a kid, you know, that was a kind of fun one to sort of try out at the dinner table and everything as well.
I mean, bringing it back to the train fight, obviously it's a one-on-one between Roger Moore's Bond and Richard Kiel's Jaws.
Yeah.
And Richard Kiel is such a memorable henchman for a lot of people. I mean, when you see books about the villains of Bond, you know, he's always the guy on the front, isn't he? What do you think made him such a special hench person?
There was a lot of things. I mean, James Bond villains have got to have something that makes them physically very different, don't they? The henchmen, certainly, you know, they have to be physically different. And he was such a physically unusual looking guy, very unique, you know, with that big heavy brow. But the teeth, obviously, was such an iconic thing. Like, it's merging Jaws and Dracula, isn't it? Like, to have terrifying teeth. He kills you with his mouth, which you'd never seen before. Killing you with a bowler hat is cool. Killing you with their mouth is actually quite frightening. And you kind of forget because they play him a little bit more for laughs later. But in that film, he really is quite scary. Like, that introduction scene where you see him in Egypt, where you have that big booming voiceover talking about the pyramids, and then the light flashes on and off and he disappears with the light and everything. You know, just he's a very eerie character and biting through chains. And when I was seven, he was frightening enough to be genuinely scary. Like I was frightened of him, you know. He was a great baddie. But at the same time, he also piggybacked on the back of Jaws itself. So it was such an iconic name. Like, Bond is kind of like the Carry-Ons, that 2 years after something is popular, Bond will assimilate it. You know, so after James Bond itself appears, you get Carry On Spying. After the Sword and Sandals epics, you get Carry On Cleo and everything, you know, so Carry On Cowboy after the Man with No Name. And it's the same thing with Bond, isn't it? So Moonraker obviously came from Star Wars' success. Mm. And Jaws. I mean, they just went right out there. They were like, right, let's just call a guy Jaws. And I love the utter shamelessness about like that. It's fantastic.
And Octopussy as well follows on from the sort of Eastern mysticism of Indiana Jones as well. Like, you can sort of definitely trace a line between those.
Although it's funny you say that, because I mean, I watched Octopussy recently and, you know, I'd never seen Octopussy and I'm a Bond fanatic, you know. But for some reason, I thought I'd seen Octopussy and I hadn't. And it was my daughter's boyfriend put me on to Octopussy. And I was like, this is amazing. I actually put it in the upper echelons of the Bonds. It's amazing. And how amazing to find a Bond you've never seen before, like a classic Bond you've never seen. It's like finding Indiana Jones 6 or Superman 8 or something, you know. It's like, it was actually wonderful to find it, you know. But I'll tell you something really interesting that I noticed is that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom obviously shares a lot of things with Octopussy, you know, with the Indian street fights and things like this, you know. But Bond came first, which is quite unusual because normally Bond follows the trend, but it actually did it a full year, maybe even slightly more than Temple of Doom. And what was amazing when I watched Spy Who Loved Me again recently in cinemas, they have the scene from Temple of Doom in Spy Who Loved Me with Barbara Bach, you know, where Bond goes in one carriage, you know, one room in the train, and she's in the other just sort of like getting ready for him to burst in and kiss her. And she's so confident that he's going to be into it. And the baddie appears, you know. And the exact same beats are used in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom with Kate Capshaw and Harrison Ford. And again, when they're just about to kiss, that's when danger strikes, you know. So it's interesting, you know. I mean, Spielberg was obviously watching these films very carefully.
Yeah. I mean, it's well documented that he got... The idea was that he wanted to do a Bond film. And when he spoke to George Lucas about it, Lucas said, you know, I've got another idea that you could do.
That
is like that, and that's how that sort of idea came to fruition. But it's interesting to trace those links between the two. Brendan, do you want to ask the question about the longevity?
What do you think is the key to the longevity and the endurance of Bond at the movies?
I think Bond's longevity is the simplest thing in the world. Now, I say this to everyone, I think there's two types of characters in films, you know, lead characters in terms of heroes. There's proactive heroes and reactive heroes, and proactive heroes last forever. So, for example, James Bond is a proactive hero. His job is to go out and find trouble, you know, to sort out a problem that exists. So it doesn't seem weird when he's on, you know, adventure number 18 or adventure 35 or whatever, because that's his job. You're like, MI6, send him out to solve these problems. Whereas John McClane is a reactive hero. John McClane was a good guy in the wrong place at the wrong time, so he had to save these people. But the idea that four or five movies in, he's in another terrorist situation, it starts to look weird, you know? So I think that's it. Longevity comes from somebody seeking out problems they're going to solve. Doctor Who, James Bond, Batman. Batman goes out every night looking for trouble.
And what do you think is the key to the series surviving another 60 years? I mean, that's a big question, but...
Well, Bond's interesting in that it does follow trends. You know, it does. Even Goldfinger has got nods to North by Northwest and everything. You know, it's a very similar structure. And like, you know, so Bond very cleverly looks around at what's currently in vogue, assimilates it, destroys the other thing, and then moves on and stays big, you know. And it's like Bond himself, isn't it? You drop Bond into the middle of the jungle and he will survive. He'll assimilate and survive, you know. And I think the franchise does the same. It's unbeatable because it will use everything to its advantage. So whatever is currently fashionable, Bond will do. And then when it's no longer fashionable, he'll jettison it and find something else. And long may it continue, you know. I'm keen to see the next wave because I got really quite bored in the last wave. It just seemed went on too long. It was only four movies over 15 years. Now, you know, two of them were good, you know, but like... you know, I'm ready for a whole new wave of James Bond, and I hope it has an entirely different feel. I do worry when I see things in the newspapers where they say, yeah, he's going to be a gentler Bond and he's going to be more empathic and everything. I was like, no, we need a funny Bond who's ruthless. You know, that's the Bond I want coming up next, that can land a joke. I think the last Bond is quite often very different from the previous Bond. You know, so Roger Moore was very different from Connery. Then you had the seriousness of Dalton. Then you had the light touch of Brosnan. Then the seriousness again of Daniel Craig. So I think this is the time to go light again. You know, somebody like Henry Cavill is exciting to me because he has a sense of fun. You know, he's got a Roger Moore vibe to him, and I could see him being great, and it would just feel fresh. It would feel new. Somebody like him in there, I think.
Yeah, I think but everyone's eagerly anticipating what happens next. But at this stage, you know, we've got the 60 years of movies to look back on and enjoy, and this is like Christmas Eve, right? We're all sitting there waiting to unwrap the present when the next one comes and see what happens. It's an exciting time.
I've got a lot of Bond friends, and I quite like pretending to them that the news has been announced, and I always pick somebody terrible, you know. And these same friends are also into Doctor Who, so I'll call them up and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe Russell Brand is the new Doctor Who," and they're like, "Oh no!" You know, I love doing this with James Bond as well. You know, just finding the worst possible people.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. John Orty from Behind the Stunts. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm fine. Yes, I'm very well. You've caught me on a good day, so all things are fine so far.
So let's dive into it. What moment have you chosen as the greatest James Bond movie moment of the last 60 years, and why?
Well, it's almost an impossible question. How I've managed to come up with one, I don't know. There are a number of major moments. However, this one for me has kind of been significant. It's the pre-title sequence in Moonraker, and I've chosen it because not only is it incredibly exciting to watch, but it's filmed in a brand new way. And bearing in mind when this was done, this was filmed in the summer of 78. So you're looking at a revolutionary way to film aerial action sequences that hadn't been done before. They played about with, you know, there were a number of movies and television series at the time, mostly movies, that had aerial escapades in some shape or form with somebody falling out of an aeroplane and parachutists and stuff of that nature. But this is, you know, right there in your face. You are going with them, and you are seeing both of the individuals. You're seeing Bond and you're seeing the pilot, and they are grappling, and then you then realise that this isn't being filmed in a studio. It's not, you know, a really shoddy backdrop at Burbank somewhere. It is actual location, and therefore there is a third person in the air, which is the cameraman. And the picture's so, you know, it's very clear. It's an extraordinary image that they're capturing. And you look at that sequence and you think, wow, you know, they've done it all in one go. And, of course, they did it over a number of weeks, taking three-second shots is what they did. So you put all of that into some sort of perspective, and then you look at what's followed. And the thing that's followed is that, you know, whatever movie you've ever seen that's had anything since 1979 that's been a parachute sequence, a fight in the midair, something of that nature, will have started from that point right there. BJ Worth and Jake Lombard are still to this day credited as being the engineers behind what we now know as aerial action cinematography. And they created that, you know, with the aid of some extraordinary pieces of equipment and the biggest cojones you've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about this sequence. I think what I also love about this specific sequence is the build-up to it, because it's got a great opening for the Bond film. And actually, the fist fight on the plane is really impressive as well. It's one of those classic, you know, close quarters battles between Bond and the pilot. But then when you see him on the edge of the plane and you just think, well, they're not going to go out without parachutes. And
surely
and then
not.
That's what they do. Yeah, and it is an astonishing moment in the movie. You've said that they had to sort of pioneer new techniques. What sort of things are we talking about here for this sequence?
There had never been a concealed wardrobe. There'd never been a concealed parachute before. From the fact of concealing it, meaning that it's underneath the clothing, you cannot see it. You see it once or twice in a couple of shots. Jake is manoeuvring himself into a certain position, and you can see around his waistband at the back there are buckles underneath his costume, which is obviously attaching the main parachute to the harness in which he's wearing underneath. The clothing then, of course, has to be designed in such a way that when the ripcord is pulled, the back of the jacket simply falls apart. It comes down the middle. There's a ripcord system in the middle, which I think originally was light stitching and now would be a Velcro or something of that nature, which simply allows the back of the wardrobe, the back of the parachute to open up, and then the jacket opens with it, and it's not, there's nothing preventing it from opening fully as it would normally in that split second. Because when you pull that chute, you want everything to just go boom and then happen. You don't want that additional weight of thinking, is my jacket opening properly? Am I going to, you know, have I got enough room between now and the ground to get this chute fully deployed? So all of these things are taken into consideration.
Of course, that's a moment that we, that's something we don't see in the movie either, is it? That's the thing that preserves the movie magic within the scene, right? Because it's the hidden one beneath the clothes that that's we're talking about, isn't it? Which is, it's quite astonishing. How many?
I was merely saying, you're in referring there, of course, to the moment that they're fighting over a parachute. What they're fighting over is an empty parachute. They're fighting over a rucksack. There's nothing in it. You know, of course, they are wearing concealed ones. And of course, for the opening of the parachute, it is BJ Worth literally wearing an actual parachute over his body in his actual suit. Then they then change. This is the final part of the sequence. So they've done all of the concealed parachute stuff, and they make sure that's okay. And then they go for the opening of the parachute, of course, where he is now in his usual, well, it's slightly different because obviously he's had to wear a number of layers underneath. Because it still would, even though it's California in the summer, it still would have been a bit parky when you're jumping from 10 or 15,000 feet. So,
and I'm sure business suits or whatever casual suits isn't the ideal thing to be skydiving in either.
No, exactly.
Must have made it very difficult to.
You do see a lot of those parachute footage these days. You know, it's a bit like running clothes. It's a bit like trainers that are not just necessarily made for walking around in. They're made for running in. They're designed specifically, and these types of clothing are exactly the same. They serve their purpose by being able to be movable. You need to have enough movement in them so that that there's no chance of fraying or splitting or anything of that nature. But more importantly, it needs to be able to keep you at a certain temperature, because obviously the higher you go, the colder it will get, regardless of how closer you are getting to the sun. The overall heat, body heat and body temperature, and adrenaline does a great deal of that for you as well. If you are absolutely on the maximum of adrenaline, which is likely if you're going to be doing extreme sports or something of that nature, and you are pumped up as much as you can be, which is always a good thing. You know, when I think BJ was interviewed once and said, "Are you nervous? You're dead right. I'm nervous. You know, but I have to be nervous, even though you know he's a world. Both of them world champion skydivers, captains of the world of the Olympic team. But more importantly, if they are nervous, there's a little something inside your head that says nerves are good. If I don't have nerves, something could go horribly wrong. So they have to have that whole thing." And wearing the right clothing and having the right attire and being able to do that is another factor of being able to just keep everything on the level so that you know that part's taken care of. You then have to worry about the actual physicality of the whole thing.
Of course, nowadays we would have much smaller, more nimble cameras than we would have done those days. So it must have taken some special equipment to capture the footage as well.
Yeah, the camera guy, of course, was wearing a helmet. It's a helmet cam, and obviously, you know, it's 1978, so it wasn't the smallest of helmet cams. It was pretty large by all accounts. That's additional weight. You're looking 6 to 8 pounds of additional weight, which means that you have to hold your body in a different way. You see Formula One racing drivers going through lots of preliminary testing and exercise to tighten their neck muscles. And this is because of the G-forces that they feel in corners when they're traveling at 140, 150 miles an hour. In connection with that, this camera, a big piece of kit on top of an already large helmet, means that you can't just move your head up and down. You have to try and be able to position it and hold it in a certain way, which means the rest of your body needs to be in a particular position to adapt it. Now, over time, if that parachute is opened relatively quickly, which of course it needs to be, the whiplash effect on that chute opening and your head coming to the upright position could be fatal. And to the point because of the additional weight on top of your head, you could break your neck. So what they then had to develop was a way in which that chute could be opened, but slower, not slowly, but slower than it would normally, allowing the body to get into a position where you're then ready to brace and then it opens. So what they did nowadays, you know, it seems awfully Heath Robinson in respect, but string tied around the cords of the chute itself, which will then, they're not tied, they're just held together so that they open slightly slower than they would normally. That's enough for then the positioning to change. And of course, over time, the size of the cameras get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where they've lipstick cams and God knows what else. And now, of course, you know, those cams that everybody's using for this type of thing. But you also don't get many big parachuting jobs in movies anymore. This was, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if filmmakers around the world have looked at a script and it says, oh, scene 237, big parachute fight. That's been done. Been done. We'll make it a car chase instead. We'll do something else because it's been done, and because Moonraker was so significant in that. The only people that really had another go, Chuck Norris had a go at it. If you remember, I think it was Missing in Action 57 or one of those. The second one, I think it was Mission Action 2, and there was a big parachuting sequence. Point Break was another one where they had a big parachuting sequence, and there's a Wesley Snipes picture which I can't think what it was off the top of my head. But that, and apart from that, you might have had the odd scene here and there, but nowhere near anything like this because people don't want to touch it with a barge pole. It's very, very, you know, it's iconic, and it's that sort of thing that you look at on the top of a mountain and go, if we could do something like that, we're never going to get that, but if we could do something that's a bit like that, then we'll be happy and the editor will be happy and the audience will be happy because they've had a big roller coaster ride. So that type of thing, but you don't get them very often these days. And when you do, you know, Mr. Cruise is a good example. He's doing it in a Mission Impossible movie, and all you can see is this. You know, go, what? Why are you doing this? Let's see the whole thing. And then film it in the day and then pretend it's night. Why? Don't do that. Oh,
yeah.
Anyway, but that's the way we are at the moment with this type of thing.
And how many jumps would it have taken to film this sequence for Moonraker, do we know?
150, 160, probably, over the space of...
incredible.
Over the space of a 3 to 6 week period. And, of course, leading up to that would have been the development of all of the equipment. And Michael Wilson is on credit as being, you know, the guy who is pretty much solely responsible for the cinematography side of it. He managed to find in a secondhand store, a junk store in Paris, a Panaflex camera, you know, which was the lens. I go, oh, that's much lighter, because before you'd have something that was very, very heavy indeed. Whereas this was the game changer. It allowed widescreen, and so okay, this is interesting. So on the strength of that, Mike Wilson's not only Mike Wilson. Look at me, like I know the guy, Mike Wilson, Mr. Wilson. is not only the producer, but he's also a very clever guy. He's very good with his physics and his mental arithmetic, and this has proved vital on a number of occasions, particularly again with BJ Work, jumping off the Eiffel Tower, for instance. He said to him,
"The view to a kill jump.
Yeah. How long do I need to?" He said, "Well, he worked out the feet per second, and said you've got 3.5 seconds." That'll be fine. Don't worry. Right. Count 3.5 seconds. The altimeter, and normally the air sound, the tone changes in your ears, and you go, bang, pull the, no, you just count 3.5, boom, pull the cord. And he's dead right, you know. So he does all of this. He's a very clever fella. So looking into the background of it and thinking, we've got this idea for a sequence, because originally the Moonraker pre-title was the Acrostar jet, of course, which was then used in in Octopussy. So they've made changes along the way and developed something and come up with it. And Michael had said, well, let's hunt them down. And he found BJ and Jake. And so he must be congratulated for that, certainly. And it's a ridiculously complicated and unbelievably exciting sequel.
It really is. And it paved the way for more parachute skydiving scenes in future Bond films as well. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's ever been embedded in this one, has it? I think it's a great choice, John. I think it's not only does it show the technical wizardry behind these films, but also works dramatically, right, as well. It's all very well and good capturing this stuff, but if it doesn't work together as a piece of film, then it's for nothing. And it really does work, sets the scene for this movie.
It's as dramatic on the screen as it is off the screen, because those moments that we talk about, even though possibly the less complicated section of that was the fight on board the plane prior to leave, which of course was all studio-based, which was Martin Grace doubling Roger for the fight. And then, of course, the last time that we saw him fight on the plane, I guess would have been Goldfinger, really, in that respect, to, you know, seeing a fuselage and then seeing a fight taking place. And, of course, the plane that they were using in Goldfinger, much bigger, lots more headroom between the top of the roof and your head. Here, not as much. It's a Learjet. It's a smaller, sleeker outfit. So the set is designed in such a way that it allows for reality. And then the continuity between the two sequences is extraordinary. And then, of course, we forget, in certain cases, you know, it's a laughable sequence, but there was a lot of people laughing last night when I saw it. But Jaws, of course, you know, is in the air as well. And skydivers aren't tall. You know, they're not tall. They're not, right. They're not over 6 feet tall as a rule. And so BJ had to find a guy who was a very good skydiver and B would look bigger on screen than the rest of them. And luckily he managed to find a guy called Ronnie Luganbill, who is 6'5", which is just lunacy. Wow. He's a very, very tall guy. Now, of course, in anywhere, if he's in a building, if he's in a car, if he's, you know, standing next to somebody, he's 6'5". But when he's 20,000 feet in the air, he's just another guy. There's no sense of size about him whatsoever. So in order to create the size of Jaws, the character at 7'2", as Richard Kiel played him, he has to, you know, be a certain, create this character by putting his wrists over at the end, and the shirt was very white. You know, it was a very sunny day. It was very white against this blue background, and he stands out. And, of course, has to have this terrible silver foil in his mouth. I mean, it's the most terrible thing, because they don't have the teeth. Even Richard Kiel was struggling with the teeth. You know, it would make, push his tongue back and make him gag every 2 minutes. But to have something around, I think it was a football player's gum shield or a boxer's gum shield they put, and they wrapped this sort of silvery foil round it and put it inside his mouth, which he then had to have for the, because they had loads of them, because every time he got to a stage where he didn't need it anymore and they pulled the shirt, just spat the thing out because he just hated it, you know. So all of that taken into consideration, it's a remarkable sequence. It really is. It's absolutely spectacular.
It really is. Right, well, just to bring it back to 60 years of Bond, why do you think James Bond films have endured for so long? What do you think is the secret formula, John?
I'm inclined to agree with Desmond Llewellyn, I think, because he always used to say that Fleming used to write that if you have the right locations, the right girls, the right excitement, you've got the right formula. And I think that's true. Moonraker is a good example of that, particularly through the Roger pictures, because they have a moment where you're introduced to the character. You know by the end of the pre-title sequence that he's the guy. Right? There's no question that it's anybody else. He's the guy that you've come to see. And I think that was very interesting in some of the reviews that I'd heard on podcasts about Spy Who Loved Me. There were guys who were bringing their children to see Spy Who Loved Me because they'd never seen it before. And there may have been some confusion early on as to, well, who's this James Bond character? And by the end of the pre-title sequence, you go, oh, it's him. Ah, okay, right. They know, you know. So at the end of a pre-title sequence, at the start of a movie, you need to know who that character is. There needs to be the fact that he's the suavest, he's the most sophisticated, you know, he's the most charming individual that there is. And he can overcome the baddies not only physically, but do it verbally. And he can also charm the ladies like the birds in the trees. It's not a problem to him. And I think that needs to come across. And he needs to do it in really exciting, fabulous locations, which, of course, it's the travelogue, as the later movies then became. Moonraker is another good example of, you know, having Drax have this particular chateau brought brick by brick from France, and then they actually film the sequence in France and then pretend that it's in Los Angeles. Very confusing, but, you know, they do this thing and they travel all over the world because that's what you do in a Bond movie. And I think that, and certainly you wouldn't have other movies because of, if it wasn't for Bond. Not in a million years would there have been the success of those, the Mission Impossible movies, the I Spy television series and stuff of this nature that was happening around that time when Bond kicked off in 62. And it wouldn't have, they wouldn't have had the longevity that they had. And this character has been in a situation where you're able to change the actor and you're able to continue. And, you know, within the first few moments of that, of each movie, you're going, okay, I'm accepting of this. Just take me on a big roller coaster ride. And that's the success of the whole thing. And long may it live, I say.
That's fantastic, John. Where can people find you? I know you're behind the stunts on Twitter and Instagram and YouTube.
Yeah, behind the stunts on the social medias, at Stunt Central on Twitter, and YouTube channel, of course, Behind the Stunts. You will find a weekly show on there. There's a podcast as well, which, again, if you're wherever you find your podcasts, if you type Behind the Stunts, you'll find me on there in some shape or form. And of course, there's the book coming out in October. So there's all sorts of bits and pieces that can be found and any other stuff that I've done there. But it's I'm easy to find. I'm not on the witness protection program just yet. So it's easy to find me anywhere.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the podcast, Steve O'Brien, entertainment journalist. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good, Steve. I'm glad to have you on to have your thoughts on James Bond and on its 60th anniversary. Let's go dive straight in. What have you chosen as your greatest Bond movie moments from the last 60 years?
Well, I originally wanted to go with the sort of air fight from Moonraker, which is quite an unfairly maligned Bond film, I find. It was the first one I ever saw in the cinema, so I've always had a sort of soft spot for it. But instead, I've gone for the cable car fight scene. I feel it feels a bit weird, like choosing something that wasn't dreamt up by one of the big names you've worked on Bond, like Roald Dahl or Richard Maybaum or even Fleming. But it's actually kind of a scene written by the writer of the Confessions films. And I still find that, I still find it that's a really odd hiring for Eon. It's a sort of a bit like if they suddenly asked the writer of Sex Lives of the Potato Men to write the next one. It seems bizarre, but I think it's a brilliant, brilliant sequence. Apparently, I found out today that from 007.com, I didn't realise that it was originally intended for the final reel of Honor Majesty's.
Yes, yeah, I'd heard that before.
And I just say, I think it's a brilliant sequence. If you look at the editing of it, there's a mix of back projection studio stuff, on location shots, and loads of different angles, and it just knits together really smoothly. And I was listening to the commentary today, and it was filmed in Sugarloaf Mountain in Brazil. And according to producer William Cartledge, they nearly got shut down. It's the owner of the cable cars. Once he'd learned that what they were going to do, which was obviously kind of it crashes at the end, he thought that that would affect business. But you know, obviously they got it sorted. And the stunt work is amazing on it.
Absolutely.
You know, so they had two stuntmen, one for Roger, obviously, and another for Keel. But obviously, kind of stuntmen of Richard Keel's size are few and far between. So what they did was just get a kind of normal sized guy and then a particularly short guy, which was which coincidentally was Roger's kind of regular stunt double, who I think was 5'8". So that you had the in long shots, you got the height difference. And when you know that, when Bond and Jaws are fighting on top of the cable car, they don't have wires attached because they're sort of weaving in and out of that sort of the metal above them, which just makes it even more sort of jaw-dropping. And, you know, I just think, you know, that's really kind of beyond the Call of Duty sort of stuff there from the stuntmen there. And when you think that the thing was 2,000 feet up in the air and, you know, that the top of it where they were all kind of where they were sort of fighting was about, according to Martin Grace, was about the size of a billiard table. That's just, you know, it's awe-inspiring.
He had his harness on underneath, but he didn't have the cable ready because this particular shot was going to take place a little later in the day. And Lewis Gilbert is over on the land and he shouted across, is the stuntman ready to fall over the side? And of course Richard didn't have his cable on, but he was so brave and he didn't want to sort of embarrass everybody by saying, well, I'm not ready. So he actually did the shot without the safety cable on.
So when I was falling down over the edge, I hung on to the top of the roof with my hands to act as a brake. I still nevertheless went over the edge.
I was so worried about this, and suddenly he fell and was hanging by his hands over this, what, 1,000-foot drop.
And that was a very nasty moment because there was nothing else you could do but go for it and hope it worked.
And, you know, technically, I think it really holds up. There's a lot of back projection, obviously, but apparently they were using this new high-def projection system, which is, what you know, is why it looks significantly better than the sort of back projection from the sort of Connery era. But it's the real stunts that really sell it. And actually, Richard Grayson, who was Moore's stunt double, he was 55 at the time, which makes it even more remarkable. And when he goes, there's a bit when he goes over the side, and you know, he wasn't wearing a harness, and he lost his grip, and you just think, you know, my God, how cavalier were they as regards health and safety in those days? You know, it's like I think he sort of said it was the most terrified he's ever been in his life. So yeah, that's my choice. It's a sequence I can watch sort of out of context to the film, you know, just fire it up on YouTube occasionally. I love the little moments, the little grace notes, the little the look that Bond gives Jaws as they sort of eye each other up, you know, just before they fight. There's a sort of little nod of acknowledgement, you know, brilliant sort of Roger moment. Yeah, I think it's got everything, this sequence.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like you say, we had someone else choose the pre-title sequence of Moonraker, and you know, regardless of what you think of this movie, you know, by some it's considered to be one of the Bond films that jumps the shark, and I think there is an argument for that because they do throw everything at it. But yes, you cannot dispute that this film has some incredible stunt sequences. And you're right. I think the credit belongs to the stunt performers, but also, like you say, the editor John Glenn, who would go on to direct five of the films. He has an efficiency in his editing, you know, probably passed down from Peter Hunt, that cannot be denied in these sequences. You talked about the writer. So Christopher Wood is the writer. Is that who you were talking about?
Yeah.
So he was known for doing the soft Confessions films.
Yeah, I mean, I think he kind of wrote a lot of these sort of softcore Confessions novels and then wrote the three movies. And I think he also did a sort of rival series to those. And I think the first one was made into the film Rosie Dixon Night Nurse, which again was a sort of softcore Brit comedy film that sort of starred a lot of kind of young nubile girls alongside sort of people like John Le Mesurier and Arthur Askey and I think kind of, they were very weird films. It was kind of weird who they were actually aimed at. But yeah, it's a really bizarre choice, you know, given how high that they'd aimed before that, you know, getting Roald Dahl in, and, you know, and Mankiewicz. And then they go with this sort of soft core, you know, sex writer.
I mean, that is, I mean, it does tell you a lot about the tone that that you ended up getting in the 70s with some of the Bond films.
Yeah, obviously the script for Spy Love Me is significantly better than Moonraker. You know, look, you know, I have a soft spot for Moonraker, but I'm not going to say it's better than Spy Love Me, even though they kind of feel like a bit like an A side and a B side to me. They definitely feel as though there's the same DNA as part of them.
Yeah, I love that description, actually, the A side, B side. I think that is very fitting. And just recalling as well, I think they looked at Anthony Burgess to write The Spy Who Loved Me. So you've gone from one extreme to the other.
Oh, I didn't know that's crazy.
Across those two movies. But I think they do make a good double bill, Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. Just thinking back to the moment, I love the moment where Jaws leaps from one cable car to the other.
Yeah, and just visually together fighting, it makes it such a memorable image because he's so hulking and, you know, just Bond just looks so weedy next to him. Just visually, it's a brilliant contrast.
It really is. And it helps that, like you were saying, it's all shot on location there as well in Rio. And that's just sort of I love the whole setting of Moonraker. It's got some really evocative places that they visit, but Rio in particular, I'm just trying to think, have they done South? I mean, they've done Cuba millions of times, yeah. But South American countries, they haven't done that many others, have they? I guess Quantum of Solace spends a lot of time in South America.
Yeah, I think that's kind of one of the reasons why I kind of love the Moore era was more travelogue-y than you know, Connery was, but you know, maybe after that, you know, they're the archetypal bank holiday films for me. You know, that the idea that we have of Bond being bank holiday experience, I think Spy Love Me and Moonraker really exemplify that. They feel absolutely at home on a bank holiday Monday at 2:30 in the afternoon, in a way that kind of no movie after Living Daylights really fits into that bank holiday tradition.
Yeah, I think I guess Living Daylights, you'd sort of say, is the last of the classic type of Bond adventures, isn't it? And
it's too nasty for an afternoon, you know, because it was the first 15, wasn't it? So.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But you're saying these sort of bank holiday movies, I always sort of think of them, put them in the same sort of category as, like, you know, the original Superman movies.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if the phrase sort of, that bank holiday movie would mean anything to anybody under the age of 30. I think you had to have grown up in a non-streaming age, you know, to know how important, like, films like Raiders of the Lost Ark or Superman the Movie or whatever were, you know, for a bank holiday, or The Great Escape even. You know, that's kind of where they belonged. And even when I watch them now on DVD, on any day, I'm transported back to a bank holiday in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, I mean, that's I guess that's a huge part of Bond's appeal, isn't it, as well? There's as everyone always says, you know, it's the first ones that you see that really stick in your mind and become very nostalgic for people, and I think that's plays a huge part in the enduring appeal of Bond. But Steve, what do you think, we're asking everyone this question, but what do you think is the secret to the longevity of the series, which now is in its 60th year?
I think it's ability to adapt, but only slightly. I think it's always a fantasy. And I think the more that they try to bring it back down to earth, I think they're kind of losing sight of what people initially like about it. I mean, there's always been this thing in Bond where they sort of bring it back down to earth and then they kind of revert to sort of default modes within a couple of movies. So you get... you know, they go back down to earth with For Your Eyes Only, and then, you know, you got back to the silliness of Moonraker within another two movies. Then they do it again with License to Kill, and then, you know, and GoldenEye, and then you've got Die Another Day at the end of that, and then they do it again in Casino, and they're embracing a lot more of the standard Bond tropes by Spectre and No Time to Die. So I don't know, whatever they do next time, you know, if they do decide to kind of strip it down again, it won't, you know, I don't think it'll ever be forever, and they'll revert back to those, you know, to what Bond's always been, which is grand escapism. You know, whenever they try to chase the Bourne thing, I think they soon realise that what people want is something very different.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I don't envy them. I think they do face a bit of an impossible task reinventing it so many times.
I can only hope that... I think the Mission Impossible films are sort of doing Bond better now than I think that perhaps that they actually are. So I think all you have to do is kind of look at them and realise that in Ethan Hunt, you've got a very uncomplicated hero that doesn't need psychoanalyzing. We don't need to delve into his backstory. And that works, and they're really big films. So, I think the next iteration of Bond, I don't think we necessarily need to go too deeply into backstory. I think, just having an escapist hero is kind of enough.
Yeah. Another guest, I'm just trying to remember who it was, they said they were of the opposite opinion, that they felt like they want Bond to be serious and they want him to be tough and gritty and the Ian Fleming angle. So I like, just even those two opposing views just, I think, highlights how complicated and how difficult it is to keep reinventing Bond and keeping everyone happy.
Yeah, it's like when you ask people their favorite Bond film, there's always going to be some who say From Russia with Love is the sort of template for them, and it never was for me. For me it's Goldfinger, it's the travelogue, it's the lightness of touch, it's the humor. And although I think From Russia with Love is the most Fleming like I didn't fall in love with the books, I fell in love with the movies. So whenever they say about taking it back to Fleming, I just think, well, only a tiny part of your audience are Fleming nuts. We fell in love with the movie Bond, and that's a different beast.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Well, thank you, Steve, for lending your thoughts. And here's to another 60 years of Bond, maybe.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Mark Edlitz, and I am the author of two books on Bond. The first is The Lost Adventures of James Bond, and the other is The Many Lives of James Bond. In honor of 007's 60th cinematic anniversary, I'm going to reveal my top 60 Bond moments. Here they are. Number 60. No, just kidding. I'm just going to talk about one. One of my favorite moments above all others is Dalton's introduction in The Living Daylights, where he turns to camera and the camera sort of moves in on him. And it's a different style of filmmaking than John Glenn normally uses, which where it's not the zoom, the camera itself seems to move in. And without Dalton saying, "My name is Bond, James Bond," you immediately know who he is. And you immediately know that this actor is going to carry on in the footsteps of the previous Bonds, and he's going to knock it out of the park and do a great job. One of the reasons that Bond has sustained all these 60 years, or at least the cinematic one, is what James Chapman calls continuity and change, which is to say continuity with the past and change going forward. So continuity with the past could mean continuing characters, continuing actors, continuing phrases, or even seeing Bond in a casino wearing a tuxedo. But it also means change to at least reflect different styles of filmmaking and different genres or subgenres, and even change in the kind of storytelling. For example, with Daniel Craig, we see serialized storytelling that we hadn't in the previous Bond films, which were all one-off adventures. And the other reason, the other reason that Bond continues is because he continues to be what Fleming described as a silhouette, which is to say he is not all knowable. We know enough about him to be intrigued, but there's also enough held back that we could project our own ideas of who this character is onto him. And so that's just a couple of the reasons why we've had the cinematic Bond for 60 years. And we'll likely have them for, or hopefully have them for 60 more. So happy anniversary, 007.
It's all so boring here, Margot. There's nothing but playboys and tennis pros. If only I could find a real man.
I need to use your phone. She'll call you back.
Who are you?
Bond, James Bond. Exercise Control 007 here. I'll report in an hour.
Won't you join me?
Better make that two.
Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast. Mr. Neil Alcock, writer, film writer, journalist, blogger. Welcome.
Hello.
An all-round Bond brain.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. I don't know whether that's a compliment or not, but I suppose it is around these parts.
Well, I remember following your exploits, Neil, back in the 50th anniversary. You did the blog on Bond.
Yeah, on my website, yeah, we did that. It was kind of a way to get a load of bloggers involved in just revisiting the series and seeing what they thought about it in a run-up to Skyfall. Yeah, it was a really fun project.
Yeah, I remember, yeah, it just devouring all those sort of different perspectives on the films, and that all that stuff still lives online and people can read that still.
Yeah.
But for the 60th anniversary, we are asking fans like yourself to talk about their favourite Bond movie moments. So what have you chosen, Neil?
Well, it wasn't an easy choice, I'll be honest, as I'm sure everybody will also say. There's loads of stuff that I love about Bond, and there are tiny, tiny split-second moments that I love, and there are great big overarching things that I love. But I have chosen to go for Bond's scenes with Saunders in The Living Daylights, and very specifically the first scene, which is the Koskov defection scene in Bratislava.
Ah, fantastic. So Thomas Wheatley playing Saunders in that film. And this is a film that only grows in stature for me every time I watch it. So what is it about that introduction to Saunders?
Timothy Dalton is my favourite Bond. That's how you recognise a Bond fan with excellent taste. So I just was watching it recently and thinking that that first scene, the defection scene, is it totally defines everything that Dalton's Bond is about. Everything that he kind of wants to do with the role is in that scene. And it's very Fleming. It's totally lifted. So that whole 5-6 minute scene is basically like a lovely condensed version of the Living Daylights short story that Ian Fleming wrote. There's a few bits missed out and there's a few bits added in, but you know, that short story is there in those 5 minutes, and it's a great mini adventure. And Saunders's character particularly is like a really great foil for Bond, and it really allows you to see the writing there really allows you to kind of see where Dalton's going to go with this.
Yes, it really is a great introduction, not just to Dalton as Bond, but as a reintroduction to Bond for a new era, because obviously this film comes on a cusp of the Bond films as we know it changing forever, really. But I think that is a really interesting dynamic that sort of grounds Living Daylight in a way that perhaps we haven't seen. I mean, I'm thinking back, you know, I mean, we see Bond with Q in the field a few times, thinking about Octopussy. But the difference between Octopussy and Living Daylights is... it's almost night and day, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is that Saunders is basically a civil servant, as is Bond to some extent. But, you know, Saunders spends all his time behind a desk, and this defection gig has come his way. He calls it my baby. And so he's kind of arranged everything and organized everything. But the one thing he can't do is kill a sniper. So there's only one person in the service good enough who has the nerve to do this job. So they have to get Bond in. And this is a really great way to kind of bring Bond into the story, I think. He's basically the guy that they call when nobody else wants to do the job. So he has to do the dirty work. He has to rock up, shoot the sniper, and then basically everybody just wants to get rid of him. And you can see it in the first scene where they meet in the concert hall, where they see Cara playing the cello for the first time. They just immediately hate each other. They don't get on with each other. Saunders doesn't really want anything to do with Bond, but he knows that he needs him to do this job, and that carries through into the stuff in the flat where Bond is going to shoot the sniper from. And I just think it shows that Bond is, he doesn't enjoy being this kind of cold-blooded murderer, but he knows he's good at it. He knows that he's the one they call when they want this dirty work doing. But also, he doesn't suffer fools. He's very professional. I mean, who doesn't love the moment where he pops his collar and pulls that little Velcro tab over to kind of black out the white of his shirt? That's just amazing. And Saunders just doesn't really like him, not because he kind of perceives him as being a bit cavalier, like he accuses him of kind of being more interested in the ladies than the job that he's doing. But also, he just doesn't like him because he's a killer, and nobody in their right mind would want to work with or be friends with a killer. And you can see why Bond doesn't have many friends, because that's just the kind of person he is, and he doesn't enjoy getting close to people, and nobody really wants to get close to him. And I find all that fascinating, and that all comes from Fleming. If you read The Living Daylights short story, everything that Fleming describes in Bond's head is kind of there in Timothy Dalton's face, in his eyes, every kind of resigned sigh that he's got to do this stuff, and just it's a weight on him, you can see it. And I just love that. I love that is how Dalton is going to do Bond.
And he talked a lot about that, didn't he, before he took the role in the run-up, how he really wanted to bring it back to Fleming. And you're right, it does all come across. But I love that you mentioned the coat and the way that he flips up the collar and pulls the thing over. It's such a delicious sort of understated moment where you know that, you know, this has been agonized over by a Q department somewhere. and it's just deployed so nonchalantly by Bond, who, like you say, he's just going about doing his job, isn't he? He's got this trigger to pull. Yeah. But also, he's got that amazing sniper rifle as well.
Oh my God, it's gigantic.
Which you've never seen anything like it before.
I think it's on the commentary, John Glenn says that it was like the latest sniper rifle. And I'm like, how do you know that? Did you? It's somebody's job to find out what the latest sniper rifle is, and that's a concern. But then he says they took it to the props department and they added even more stuff onto it just to make it look ridiculous. But Dalton carries it off. John Glenn says, you know, Timothy Dalton was really good with props, and you can, you know, he holds this stuff like he knows what he's doing.
Absolutely, yeah.
You just can't see Roger Moore doing that, you know. There's a lot about The Living Daylights, which obviously we know was carried over from the Roger Moore era, and part of it is a bit Roger Moore-y, but that scene in the flat, you just can't imagine Roger Moore doing it. When Dalton then goes off to the pipeline factory or whatever the hell it is, and Rosie is there with her gigantic décolletage, that all that is total Roger Moore, that stuff. And I don't know, Dalton carries it off well, but you can see that he's much more comfortable doing the previous stuff.
Yeah. There is I know that the story is that, you know, this film was not written necessarily with the actor in place for it. Mm. So you can sort of sense that throughout Living Daylights, there is a push and pull with the tone. Just to bring it back to Saunders, then, something I love about Living Daylights is how their story evolves, Bond and Saunders.
So they have like three pretty short scenes together. I don't think Saunders is in the film for 10 minutes at most. There's like a perfect arc of a relationship throughout those three scenes. And in the second scene, which is where they meet again in a different concert hall in Vienna, where Bond tells him to go and find out some information on the Stradivarius. It's really lovely little switch, because in the first scene, Saunders is in charge, it's his operation, and he's telling Bond what to do. And then in the second scene, the roles are reversed and Bond is now very clearly in charge. And he tells Saunders to go off and find out how Koskov could afford to buy this Stradivarius. And he tells him the name of he says it's called the Mary Rose. And Saunders is like, a cello with a name? And Bond puts him totally in his place. And just, you can see it in Thomas Wheatley's performance is great, because he plays it like an officious kind of idiot, but at the same time he's quite likable. And throughout that scene, he realizes that Bond knows what he's doing and that he might be able to help him rescue this botched operation. And so there's a bit of he gives him a little smile and he says, I've got nothing to lose but my pension. Turns out that was not quite correct.
Well, very much so, yeah. And that, the way that Bond knows what the cello's called, it calls back to this idea of Fleming's idea of Bond being a very cultured man. Of course, Bond would know that sort of stuff, right? But yeah, I mean, that final scene where it all comes together then at the fairground, that's where, yeah, I guess Bond and Saunders then converge into a sort of a mutual admiration, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it, like I say, it's an arc with almost three acts, and the last act is he comes through, even though he says, you know, there's no way I can get that information that quickly or get clearance for whatever, and then he comes through with this stuff. And there's a real kind of kinship there. They realise that actually they know each other's places in their relationship and in the business. And Bond says thank you, and they shake hands, and you get the sense that kind of everything's okay. And here are two guys who could go on to work together and have lots more adventures, maybe.
But sadly,
yeah.
Sadly, not.
It turns out to be not the case.
Not the case. Yeah, we've got. Yeah, we've got the henchman comes in and tinkers with the door, which is quite a terrifying idea, really, and well executed, excuse the pun, in the movie.
How scared were you about going through sliding glass doors after first seeing that? I know I was.
Very, very much so, yeah. And I do wonder whether the glass doors have that capacity to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear, I don't think, what's going on, because either he's tinkered somehow with the speed of the door with his little Walkman, or he's put some kind of explosive device in there that blasts it closed. I don't know. It's not. Obviously, it doesn't really matter. But I think the scene is so well done as well, because you see Saunders go through and you see him kind of lunge through as the door's closed, but you don't actually see anything super horrific. You just get that shattering of the door and this kind of screams of everybody in the cafe, and then you get Dalton's kind of shocked, alarmed look that something has horribly gone wrong. And he goes over to Saunders's body and he kind of looks really resigned and not just sad, but kind of, oh God, you know, this is what happens to people in our business. Another one bites the dust. This is, you know, this is such a shit business. And then the balloon kind of floats over and he squeezes in. He's so angry, and I love it. I love the look on Dalton's face at that point, because he just looks absolutely furious and he's so cross that he pops a balloon with his bare hands and then kind of goes off after the killer, because he thinks that there's some balloons on the other side of the hedge, and he goes and jumps over the hedge and he pulls a gun on a little kid. And that's like, you know, he's so kind of beside himself with rage that he does something really, really stupid. And I think that's all part of humanizing Bond that nobody else really got until Daniel Craig.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I think you've picked an absolutely blinding moment to choose from. After with 60 years of moments to choose from, you've chosen a great one, and I'm glad to have some more Dalton love within these specials. We've had a lot of talk about Connery and also other eras, but yeah, to get some more Dalton in here is terrific.
Always happy to spread the Dalton love for us.
What do you think, if I had to put you on the spot, Neil, what do you think is the secret to the enduring appeal of the James Bond films? Why have they lasted for 60 years?
I guess it's just reinvention, isn't it? It's all based in a character that Fleming created who is not really a hero. He's not really very likable. And so there has been this kind of attempt over 60 years to make a heroic and likable character out of an unlikable, blunt instrument. And so there's that kind of dichotomy is going on all the time. And I think that's really interesting. And that's why you get so much change throughout the series and reinvention, because those two sides are always kind of at war with each other, and I don't think they'll ever quite get it right. For me, it should be quite far on the other side of likable. You know, he should be quite unpleasant, and I don't think that these, you know, I'm quite a boring Bond fan in that I think these shouldn't really be kids' films, and the Roger Moore, as much as I love Roger Moore, those aren't, that's not the way I see my Bond. But, you know, the reason it's gone on so long, and the secret of its endurance, is that it appeals to different ones different appeal to different people, and the reinvention keeps it fresh. And also, it's just amazing.
That's a great answer. And I know when we talked about you coming on, you mentioned sort of also how you enjoyed that the series wasn't afraid to take big swings when it needed to. And you're right. And I think that is all part of the reinvention, is that you can't just keep reheating the same thing and serving it up and hoping people will come back. You've got to take those risks, which they do. And obviously they have taken a massive risk, probably the biggest risk of all with the most recent film.
Yeah. No, that's the thing I love about Bond the most is when risks are taken. I guess Honor Majesty's Secret Service was probably the first big risk, and I absolutely love that film. License to Kill was a huge risk. And then the way that Daniel Craig approached it, full stop, was you know, nobody was quite ready for that. And certainly nobody was really ready for the end of No Time to Die. And my heart exploded with excitement when I realized that Bond was going to die, which is a kind of crazy thing to think. But I thought, oh God, they're actually going to do it. They're going to do something really risky and really amazing, and absolutely applaud that. I know it's not the most popular thing that's ever happened in a Bond film, but I loved it.
Well, listen, I'm completely on your side with that, but you are right. I don't think it works for everyone, but for me, I thought, I was in shock when it happened, but because I didn't think they would do it, and I think that's also the genius of it, is that they went and did it.
I can't wait to see how they're going to get out of it.
It'll be nanotechnology, smart blood, something. It'll just be another whole new reinvention, and I actually can't wait to find out. What that looks like. I'm glad I'm not the person that's been tasked with doing it, though.
No, me too. And I'm excited about not knowing, because I just can't imagine what's going to happen, and I'm excited to find out.
Hi Brendan, hi Tom. My favorite underappreciated sequence in a Bond film would have to go to my favorite Bond film of all time, which is License to Kill, and that is Bond's escape from the Wavecrest facility. The underwater sequences are brief and exciting, which pretty much remedies everything from Thunderball, if you ask me. And I also like it how Bond shoots a harpoon gun on the back of a seaplane and water skis it. You know, he comes out of the water and he water skis behind the plane, which creates a very exciting, brief, exciting chase. And also, you know, coupled that with Michael Kamen's score, it creates an absolutely exhilarating moment in the series, if you ask me. I also like the top-off where Bond takes the wad of money, smiles at it, and throws it into the back of the plane. I think that's a very nice send-off.
Hello and welcome back to the James Bond A to Z podcast, Mr. Mark Harrison. How are you?
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back. I'm good.
So we're asking people to name their favourite moment from the Bond films over the last 60 years. What have you gone for?
Well, it's not that one. It's not the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, but I do like a lot of bits from The Spy Who Loved Me. It's a bit from another favourite of mine, which is License to Kill. It's specifically the bit that I think is just an underrated moment, I would say, in not so much in just in Timothy Dalton's Bond films, because, you know, there's just the two of them, but I would say in the whole lot, I think it's an underrated moment. It's the bit when he boards the Wavecrest and then escapes from the Wavecrest and ruins Sanchez's drug shipment. Not only soaking a load of cocaine, but also making off with $5 million. Stop me if I get a little Alan Partridge. So, like, the lead up to this is all of the, you know, revenge, all of the revenge thriller type stuff. And I think like one of the reasons I love this film so much is it's one of the Bond films, one of the rare Bond films, I think, before Daniel Craig, where he's showing a real range of emotion. And that's not just rage and grief and anger and more rage and and all of that good stuff. I think that this action set piece is so perfectly designed around the bit that I love about it so much, which is that when it gets to the end of it, Dalton is laughing. It's like when we find Dalton in the cockpit after he's done all that, after he's gone through all of that stuff. Like it's all, you know, the set piece itself is very in keeping with the dark tone of the film. He's gone from being in Lupe's cabin, and he sees them bring in Sharky dead, and he's dark as out, as always, textbook Dalton, when he's sneering at Lupe that she seems fine with Sanchez's way when it's Sanchez. Then has to escape. When he's snorkeling under the water, he you know, rips the cocaine open. Chris sees him on camera, kicks off, sets some snorkel bastards on him. He fights them off in the only good snorkeling fight of the series, for my money. So you know, you've got like, I think it's one of John Glenn's best action sequences as well. It's an idea that exists in like the very first treatment for the film that Richard Maybaum and Michael G. Wilson came up with, is that he water skis barefoot behind a seaplane as it takes off from the money. He's got used a harpoon gun as a tow, and he's got no skis, and everyone's shooting at him. Again, I'm getting a little Alan Partridge just describing this, so I'm gonna keep it brief. Michael Kamen sticks a little bit of the Bond theme in this particular bit, because there's such a Bond moment, the whole water skiing barefoot thing. Gets up there, fights the pilots. I think that the newer Mission Impossible films nick a lot from these 80s James Bond films, by the way. This, like, and you know,
100%.
Yeah, the pilot looking out of the window and seeing that there's someone hanging on when he's been flying for a little while is replicating Fallout to amazing effect as well. But you know, fights off the pilots, takes control of the plane, and flies back past the wave crest just to drop one of the pilots' bodies in front of crest and fly off again. And that's the Bond theme comes back in the score again there. But it's not like the big brass, it's not like a big bombastic moment. It's a little bit like the bit that Thomas Newman does later on in Skyfall, like the guitar bass line coming in, you know, when they catch Silver, when all the helicopters turn up. So it's just like a cool as you like, you know, drop of that theme. And although, like, all of this action set piece is steeped in, like, the jeopardy that comes with, like, these two, the Timothy Dalton films, where Bond's world feels dangerous, it's, like, a really elegant and entertaining solution to a problem of where Bond is in the story at this point. Like, he's already got his plan to sort out about Crest's loyalty for what follows, because he's going to go in there and mess up Sanchez. And now that he's not dining out on the British taxpayer, he's also got millions of Sanchez's own money to wage war against him. At the culmination of which is putting the money back on the wave crest and getting to that nice gory 15 certificate worthy moment. But as I say, at the end of all this, we find Dalton in the cockpit with fistfuls of dollars. It's another Yojimbo connection there. And he's laughing his ass off. It's just a rare moment, like, from someone who's considered serious. It's not the only moment in which he laughs. You see him in Love and Daylights being quite good boyfriend material and having a nice time on a roller coaster. But it's a rare moment. It's a rare moment for Bond altogether. There's only, I can't think of too many more times where he's laughing and enjoying himself. There's maybe, yeah, there's a little bit in the back seat in Tomorrow Never Dies, and there's sort of performative bit when he's on the wrong end of a bit of rope in Casino Royale. But you know, it's like, at the time of recording, that clip's going around again of Dalton absolutely hitting the nail on the head about Bond as a character, is that there's disdain for his job, is that he's in some ways as bad as the people that he's fighting. It's just that he happens to be on the government who declared the good guys. And I think that holds up, and I think that's absolutely key to a lot of his performance. But it's wild that he also, in that moment, in this one moment of perfect shithousery, just enjoys his job. Did I drop
that?
Yeah,
I mean, sorry. No, it's fine. Yeah, I think it's a fantastic moment that you've chosen. And I think I'm in agreement with you that it's probably... I think the John Glenn era is a difficult one for me to get a grip on, but you know, he steered that Bond ship through a difficult era through the 80s. I think, you know, I think the series was struggling a little bit with its identity, and I really feel like License to Kill is a culmination of everything that he's tried so far coming together. I think it's by far his strongest James Bond movie.
Definitely.
And I much prefer it to Living Daylights as well, and for Dalton as well. And what I love about this film as well is sort of how it ties into, it's very different to the Bond films that we've had before, but it's also ties into the heritage and the legacy, you know, with Felix Leiter and it being driven by the death of Leiter's wife, which we, as we know, and we are reminded at the start of this film, happened in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which was, what, 20 years ago at this point in the Bond franchise. And yeah, I think the sequence that you've chosen is just absolutely one of those moments that really sings in that movie. and you mentioned the guy on the water skis. And it was, I think it was an idea that they had, but then they had just had to find someone who could actually do it. And they could only find like a handful of people that could actually do it for real. It's such a harebrained scheme.
Yeah, didn't they have to put the guy on like transparent skis as well, that even to, you had to cheat a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. And you mentioned Miss It. Go on.
I was just going to say, I've read the treatment, like the original treatment before before recording, and like there's, when it gets to that bit, it's like, see Appendix B, and there's some storyboards they've hand drawn of like, we've written he's going to barefoot ski behind a plane, and here's a drawing of it. Now you have to go figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Classic John Glenn. Can you go figure that out, lads? But yeah, no, it's a terrific sequence. It's all really put together. And I think, again, one of those moments where, like the opening of For Your Eyes Only, where you can see John Glenn's experience as an editor coming into play, in that he shoots so economically, everything's put together with precision, and like you say, combined with the use of the James Bond theme, it's just one of those standout moments. I think it's a great sequence, and in that movie, you know, you've got a few really really good action stunt set pieces that you could have chosen. I personally love the truck chase at the end as well, for its sheer bravado. And you mentioned Mission Impossible, and the one that always reminds me is where, you know, they knocked Sanchez off the water into the sea, and they lift that directly. Is it Fallout, that one they use in Mission Impossible?
No, it's Mission Impossible 3. Has that, but they do. They also do it in Fallout as well. Yeah, it's Mission Impossible 3, the J.J. Abrams one, that has almost, it almost looks like the same bridge, like in the way that it sets up. It looks like a full direct lift from License to Kill, but it does that thing of him being recovered. But yeah, you're right. They do it in they do it in Fallout as well. But this the thing they nick in that I always remember is the bit where it's in the water and it's the sort of Dunkirk shot of like the water rising, but it's on the wrong angle, so it looks like it's going sideways.
Yeah, that's it.
They've nicked that a couple of times then, Mission Impossible.
Well, and I think a lot of the aerial stuff as well you see has been recycled in Mission Impossible. You know, people sort of talk about these stunts, and I think you can pin a lot on the excitement for them because Tom Cruise did it for real. But these stunt people in James Bond were doing it for real as well. It's just that they're not, you know, not Tom Cruise, not the movie stars. So they deserve as much credit as he does. But I think it's a terrific moment you've chosen there, Mark. You could have chosen anything from 60 Years. And I think you've picked a real humdinger, a Bobby Dazzler, as my nan would say. So Mark, what do you think is the secret to the longevity of Bond? How has it survived for 60 years? Big question.
Yeah, it is a big question. I think, I mean, you mentioned that in the 80s it has something of an identity crisis. There is that. I think that somewhere in the middle of that decade it becomes the most Bond formula, I would say, that you can get out to, that by the time we're View to a Kill, it's the Bond formula, irrespective of the fact that Roger Moore is 57 years old and that there are a lot of submen around, and the Bond is most unflappable, I would say, at this point in it. Like, even with everything else going on around him, like, even with this more violence, I think, in Roger Moore's last two Bond films than there is in, you know, certainly more violence in the John Glenn directed ones than there are in the earlier ones. And I think that that's coming right after Moonraker. That's an effort to bring it down, you know, down to earth again. And by the time Review to a Kill, you have this sort of, like, really tropey, you know, it's embracing James Bond at its most formulaic. And then the very next film that comes in, Timothy Dalton finally stops saying no to them. And says, all right, we have to take this back to, you know, to Fleming a little bit. And then that goes for a while. And again, it just comes back. I think it's the, I don't want to say boom and bust, but I think it's sort of like pushing the envelope and then knowing when to step back, I would say, is one of the things. Like, Dying of the Day, as everyone always observes, was a massive hit at the box office. Like, you know, the commentary on Dying of the Day famously ends with Pierce Brosnan saying, I think it'll go on in this direction. He says something to the effect of like, there's lots of, you know, cries for people. There's lots of demand for seeing his origins and taking it back to basics, back to Ian Fleming. I don't think it will go that way. And, of course, the very next film comes out is Casino Royale and everyone enjoys it. It's usually acclaimed. But it wasn't necessarily the next step you would take looking at the box office of Dying of the Day. So I said this on the No Time to Die episode, but I have no idea where they go next. But I think that instinct of, you know, when to pull back has kept it. I mean, it's not kept it from doing hover gondolas or invisible cars or kite surfing or any of that stuff. But I think that's possibly it. I think that sense of...
But again,
I think
yeah, knowing that when to hit the reset button, I think is important. And it has had that moment. A few times, hasn't it? I think you can point to You Only Live Twice as a moment where they realised they had to dial things back after that one. And they seem to have managed to make the right decisions, and that's helped. Sadly, the one that you chose, License to Kill, is one of the lowest grossing movies in the series. But it led to GoldenEye, one of the biggest hits of the series. So, and now we live in an era where many people consider License to Kill to be one of the best Bond films yet, including me. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's a great point. So, well, thanks for joining us again, Mark. It's been a real pleasure.
I've enjoyed it. Lovely to speak to you.
James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe and leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
There's $2 million in that suitcase. I'll split it with you. You earned it. You keep it, old buddy.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.